Okay, here we go. Samuel chapter 10 and 11. Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him. He said, "The Lord has anointed you ruler over his people Israel. You shall reign over the people of the Lord, and you will save them from the hand of their enemies all around. Now this shall be the sign to you that the Lord has anointed you ruler over his heritage. When you depart from me today, you will meet two men by Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. They will say to you, 'The donkeys that you went to seek are found. And now your father has stopped worrying about them and is worrying about you, saying, "What shall I do about my son?" Then you shall go on from there further and come to the oak of Tabor. Three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you there, one carrying three kids, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a skin of wine. They will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you shall accept from them. After that, you shall come to Gibeath Elohim, at the place where the Philistine garrison is. There, as you come to the town, you will meet a band of prophets coming down from the shrine with harp, tambourine, flute, and lyre playing in front of them. They will be in a prophetic frenzy. Then the Spirit of the Lord will possess you, and you will be in a prophetic frenzy along with them and be turned into a different person. Now when these signs meet you, do whatever you see fit to do, for God is with you. And you shall go down to Gilgal ahead of me. Then I will come down to you to present burnt offerings and offer sacrifices of well-being. 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what you shall do." As he turned away to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. When they were going from there to Gibeah, a band of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God possessed him, and he fell into a prophetic frenzy along with them. When all who knew him before saw how he prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, "What has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" A man of the place answered, "And who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" When his prophetic frenzy had ended, he went home. Saul's uncle said to him and to the boy, "Where did you go?" And he replied, "To seek the donkeys." And when we saw they were not to be found, we went to Samuel. Saul's uncle said, "Tell me what Samuel said to you." Saul said to his uncle, "He told us that the donkeys had been found. But about the matter of the kingship of which Samuel had spoken, he did not tell him anything." Samuel summoned the people to the Lord at Mizpah and said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and I rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians, from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But today you have rejected your God who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses, and you have said, 'No, but set a king over us.' Now therefore present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." Then Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its families, and the family of the Matrites was taken by lot. Finally, he brought the family of the Matrites near man by man, and Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by lot. But when they sought him, he could not be found. So they inquired again of the Lord, "Did the man come here?" And the Lord said, "See, he has hidden himself among the baggage." Then they ran and brought him from there. When he took his stand among the people, he was head and shoulders taller than any of them. Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see the one whom the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." And all the people shouted, "Long live the king!" Samuel told the people the rights and duties of the kingship, and he wrote them in a book and laid it up before the Lord. Then Samuel sent all the people back to their homes. Saul also went to his home at Gibeah, and with him went warriors whose hearts God had touched. But some worthless fellow said, "How can this man save us?" They despised him and brought him no present, but he held his peace. Now Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had been grievously oppressing the Gadites and the Reubenites, he would gouge out the right eye of each of them and would not grant Israel a deliverer. No one was left of the Israelites across the Jordan whose right eye Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had not gouged out. But there were 7,000 men who had escaped from the Ammonites and had entered Jabesh-Gilead. About a month later, Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a treaty with us, and we will serve you." But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, "On this condition I will make a treaty with you, namely that I gouge out everyone's right eye, and thus put disgrace upon all Israel." The elders of Jabesh said to him, "Give us 7 days' respite, that we may send messengers through all the territory of Israel. Then, if there is no one to save us, we will give ourselves up to you." When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, they reported the matter in the hearing of the people, and all the people wept aloud. Now Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and Saul said, "What is the matter with the people that they are weeping?" So they told him the message from the inhabitants of Jabesh. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul in power when he heard these words, and his anger was greatly kindled. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by messengers, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." Then the dread of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out as one. When he mustered them at Bezek, those from Israel were 300,000, and those from Judah 70,000. They said to the messengers who had come, "Thus shall you say to the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, 'Tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance.'" When the messengers came and told the inhabitants of Jabesh, they rejoiced. So the inhabitants of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will give ourselves up to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you." The next day Saul put the people in three companies. At the morning watch they came into the camp and cut down the Ammonites until the heat of the day, and those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. The people said to Samuel, "Who is it that said, 'Shall Saul reign over us? Give them to us so that we may put them to death.'" But Saul said, "No one shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has brought deliverance to Israel." Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go up to Gilgal and there renew the kingship." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they sacrificed offerings of well-being before the Lord, and there Saul and all the Israelites rejoiced greatly. The word of the Lord. All right. Yeah. It's an exciting couple of chapters. And it starts out with a continuation from the end of chapter 9, where Samuel anoints Saul with a vial of oil and kissed him. And this was a typical way of marking someone out for a special office. You can see this in Judges chapter 6, verses 11 to 16. You can also see it in Exodus chapters 3 and 4, and pretty much anywhere where you see a king being anointed in a ritual way. And the fact that this chosenness of Saul by God being mediated by a prophet is meant to indicate that the king acts as a viceroy of types who doesn't really rule the king, but only does so sort of in God's stead. And so the term here used around Saul's kingship is sort of king designate, or a prince of sorts. And his job will be not just to rule, but to save over what God has created in the people. And Samuel gets ready to send Saul away, and he says, there's going to be three signs. And the first sign is you're going to find your donkeys. And I'm sure that came as great relief. Of course, this is an act of prophecy. You're going to bump into a couple of guys. They're going to be near Rachel's tomb. We don't know exactly where it was. But she died giving birth to Benjamin, was buried roughly in what's now Benjamite territory. And then you'll go on further, and you're going to meet three guys who are going up to Bethel to make sacrifice. and they're going to have 3 loaves of bread, and they're going to give 2 to you. And this is almost kind of a sacramental situation where, just like with the best part of the sacrifice in chapter 9, the thigh, that normally is set aside for the priest, but in this case was given to Saul, he's going to receive these 2 loaves of bread that were intended for God. This doesn't define him in a priestly role, but it emphasizes the nature of his kingship and how God has sanctioned it. And then he's going to go on to a place called Gibeah Elohim, which means hill of God, and he's going to bump into a band of prophets, and they're going to be in an ecstatic state. It wouldn't be unfair to think of the charismatic churches today, where people are speaking in tongues and dancing and essentially have been sort of been taken hold of by the Spirit of God or the life-giving breath of God. And they're going to be playing instruments common to that era used in worship. And the Spirit of God will seize Saul and bring him into a prophetic frenzy and change him. You'll be turned into a different person. He's going to be given another heart. And so he's going to be transformed. And then after this experience, he's to go to Gilgal and wait for Samuel for 7 days. And then receive further instructions from Samuel. And all the signs were fulfilled, but the narrative only focuses on the third one, the most extraordinary of the three. And people who sort of knew Saul beforehand were kind of surprised to see him behaving in this way, because he had not been perceived as a prophet. And this doesn't sort of put Saul in a prophetic role in the same way that Samuel and others who will succeed Samuel will be. But it is a way of demonstrating the power of God that's come upon him. And apparently there was sort of a saying that emerged from this: is Saul also among the prophets? And we don't really know what that means. As time goes by and language changes, it can be perplexing to know what our ancestors meant. For instance, in Shakespeare, he speaks of a woman in a complimentary way of "she stinketh like a rose." Well, when we think of stink, we think of skunks or rotten garbage, but to stinketh merely meant to smell like something in Shakespeare's day. And MacArthur had some useful thoughts on this. And I've included this quotation in your notes. "In common use, this saying may have been applied to situations involving participation in a particular group or activity by an individual who, for one reason or another, would not have been expected to participate. Such a saying might easily have arisen from popular familiarity with Saul's reputation as an antagonist of the prophets. When someone would find an unlikely individual involved in some group, therefore he would say, 'Is Saul too among the prophets?'" And then he goes on to give some explanation as to the slightly mysterious question, "And who is their father?" And basically, it's pretty obscure, but oftentimes when you'd have a band of holy people, priest or prophet, the leader would be referred to as father, not unlike the way we refer to male priests as father today. And so they may have been wondering, who is the leader? Could it be Saul? So when this ecstatic experience of the Spirit ends, he goes home. And interestingly, it's Saul's uncle and not his father who greets him and wants to know where he's been. And you would have think the uncle would have already known, but Saul says, "Well, we went to go find the donkeys, and we couldn't find them, so we went to Samuel." And Saul's uncle says, "Well, what does Samuel say?" And he only tells him part of the story. He says, "Well, he told me where to find the donkeys." But he doesn't breathe a word about Saul's prophecy of his becoming a king and all the things that Samuel did to essentially mediate that coming to pass. And it's no explanation is given as to sort of why he keeps the secret. Maybe that kairos moment, that godly moment, has not yet arrived. And then Samuel summons the people for sort of a conclave of sorts. If you want to think about maybe a diocesan convention or the general convention, this would have been it. Except instead of delegates or deputies, everybody comes. And hearkening back to chapter 8, verses 19 through 22, Samuel starts out by saying, well, you people asked for a king, and God's not too happy about it. And he proclaims an oracle of God that says, you know, I'm the one that sprung you free from Egypt. I'm the one that got you out from underneath the people oppressing you, but you rejected me. I'm the one who saved you from all your troubles, but you've rejected me, and you've said, we want a king, so you're going to get one. And it's sort of an oracle of judgment, and it's intriguing in that he's going to give them what they want, but it's going to be, on balance, more curse than blessing. And the way that they're going to do this publicly, because so far the identification of Saul as the coming king, as the regent designate, has been a private matter between him and Samuel, but now publicly they're going to confirm this by drawing lots. And so that was a common practice in the ancient world, to try to divine God's will. You see it in the Acts of the Apostles. They're one short now that Judas Iscariot has betrayed Jesus and killed himself. They need a replacement. They establish criteria. They narrow it down to two equally qualified candidates. Can't make up their minds. And so they choose lots to see who's going to be the new number 12. And so you see this happening a lot. And so they start by bringing all 12 tribes up. And we're not sure about the exact mechanism, but it could have been, as simple as, different colored stones, where you'd have, 11 light-colored stones and one dark-colored stone. And whichever tribal representative drew out the different stone, that was the tribe. And then they repeated the process using each clan or family of the tribe of Benjamin. That gets it down to the family of Matri. And then all the Matrites draw, and it comes down to Saul, which is interesting because he apparently wasn't around. So apparently all the family members draw, and the only stone left over is the one for Saul. But they couldn't find him. And so they wonder, well, did he show up? Where is this guy? And again, they ask God, and it's an easily overlooked detail, but this is important because once more they're seeking out God's sanction of this kingship and the proper identification of the man to whom it belongs. And God said, he's hiding among the baggage. And we don't know why. Later, Jewish commentators on this text have indicated that he did so out of humility. Maybe he was afraid, which would have been a natural human reaction to this. So they go and grab him, and again, it talks about how much taller he has than anybody else. That's the only thing that's special about Saul in this whole process. Man, he was tall. So, I guess, yeah. Samuel praises Saul as one unique among the people, asks them to witness that he, in fact, is the chosen king, and they affirm this. And then Samuel explains the responsibilities and the privileges of the king, and apparently wrote them in a book. And we don't have this book anymore. But what it shows is that the powers of the kingship was meant to be constrained by regulations expressed by God through the prophets. Now, as we'll see as we move deeper into the books of Samuel and then later on into the books of the kings, as generation after generation passed and the kingship consolidated its power, any real meaningful restraint on the kings evaporated, and of course this resulted in great disaster. And so in a way, this articulation that Samuel pronounced and then inscribed, these regulations are kind of a warning and a prophecy for the future. It was set up right, but it went wrong in a pretty big hurry. And then everybody goes home. It's kind of anticlimactic. And so does Saul. He goes back to Gibeah. And, you know, to expect him to get on with, you know, doing kingly types of things, you know, setting up a capital somewhere, you know, building himself a palace, all the things that newly crowned kings do. And then kind of as a side note, in verse 27, it does mention, oh, thank you, Peter, appreciate it. It does mention that there were some who were described as worthless men who did not affirm Saul's elevation to the throne. And they express this by not bringing him tribute. I mean, the way that you honor a king is to bring some sort of gift. And they refused to do that. But much to his credit, he kept his cool. But he's still not quite king yet. Maybe that's why he hasn't done any of those things that you would expect a king to do after his coronation. But an event will occur that will really inaugurate his reign. And we have Nahash, king of the Ammonites, to thank for that. There are so many things that could be said about Nahash, much of which shouldn't be said in mixed company. But he was a nasty piece of work. He ruled a kingdom on the east side of the Jordan River, and which was up next to the territory of the tribes of Gad and Reuben. And this was contested territory. There were multiple claims on it. And apparently he'd gone around gouging out the right eye of every man he could find. And, of course, this was a terroristic action. It was intended to intimidate, to cow the people, to be a very visible sign, if you pardon the pun, of his domination over them, and to ensure that he literally crippled any man who might be able to rise to a position to offer any resistance. But 7,000 of them get away, and they flee to Jabesh Gilead. A month goes by, and he goes up, and he lays siege to that city. And they try to make a treaty, but he demands unconditional surrender. Basically, he says, the only terms I'll agree to are for you to let me do what I came to do in the first place, which is to gouge out the right eye of all these men. And so they say, well, give us 7 days. We'd like to send out messengers to see if anybody will come and help us. And it's sort of surprising that he would have granted that request. Maybe he was arrogant enough to believe that nobody would come to help them. Or maybe he thought that whatever help would be brought, he would be able to easily defeat, and that would give him more right eyes to gouge out. But that's sort of beside the point. They send out messengers, and they arrive at Gibeah, and naturally people are very upset. And Saul comes in from plowing the field. So here's this newly acclaimed king, and he's farming. And he wants to know what everybody's upset about, and they let him know. And the Spirit of God comes to Saul and drives him into a rage. So he takes some oxen, slices them up into pieces, and he sends them with the messengers to all of Israel with this rather stern message. If you don't come to help, your oxen are going to wind up like these oxen. And it could be more than a literal meaning to this. There could also be a metaphorical meaning that he's not just threatening their oxen with destruction, but he's threatening them. And this is really where Saul becomes king, because he moves beyond the role of the judges who have sort of been the administrators of Israel up until this point. Judges were able to consolidate neighboring tribes for limited periods of time to work together on things like common defense. But the unity of all 12 tribes, of both the northern and southern kingdoms as they eventually became, This was unprecedented. Even to make the claim was a remarkable step. And people felt the dread of the Lord. And this dread is something that's normally felt by opponents of God. This is the sort of dread that the Philistines felt when they realized that the Ark of the Covenant had finally come into the Israelite camp. But in this case, it falls upon the people, and they respond robustly. They go together to Bezek. Again, it says 300,000 people from Israel, 70,000 from Judah. Oftentimes, these numbers are inflated, or they represent units. So instead of 70,000, it would represent, say, 70 squads or 70 platoons, which is still a sizable number of people. And depending on the source you use, the numbers vary. So in some of the ancient manuscripts, it's 700,000 from Israel. Nevertheless, sizable force. And so he sends in messengers to the besieged people of Jabesh-Gilead and say, tomorrow we're coming and we're going to set you free. And then in, you know, Sun Tzu would have been very proud, even though he wasn't alive yet. So the people lie to Nahash, and they said, you know, we give up. Tomorrow you can come in with your grapefruit spoon and do your worst. And so he's expecting a surrender on his terms, which would have had to have led into the assumption that there was nobody there. Bezek, by the way, we don't know where that is, but it was probably about a day's march from Jabesh-Gilead, probably 10 to 12 miles. So they were far enough away that, you know, unless he really was running his pickets well, he might not have known about their presence. So the next morning, Saul divides his forces into three, and most likely what he did was an enveloping maneuver with a central thrust. And he just wipes them out. I mean, it's a total slaughter. So no more eye gouging for Nahash for a while. And then there was those people, if you'll remember, who were kind of skeptical about Saul, and they say to Samuel, the people who affirmed him say to Samuel, so who are these people who didn't think Saul was our guy? Let's kill him. And Saul says, no, we're not going to do that. For today the Lord has brought deliverance to Israel. And that's an important point. He ascribes the victory to God. And this is another validation of his rightful claim as king. Unfortunately, you're off to a good start, but in a very short period of time, this sort of fidelity and reverence will begin to pass. Samuel then brings the people up to Gilgal to renew the kingship. And basically what this is a confirmation, because it's through these events, it's through this battle won, that Saul's role as king is really cemented. And so this renewal is more of a public confirmation. They go up and sacrifice and rejoice, and thus ends the story, at least in chapter 11. So, questions, comments, stuff like that. We got a lot of fun stuff happening here.
What was Nahash's heritage? I mean, he wasn't Israelite, was he?
No. He's only mentioned a couple of times elsewhere in Hebrew scripture. He's in First Chronicles, but it doesn't tell us anything about him. It just mentions him. So we really don't know anything about this guy except that he was a massive jerk. I mean, huge.
The eyes have it.
The eyes have it. I can always count on you, bud. I appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, the Ammonites and the Israelites, with rare exception, were always in conflict with one another. And it was about competing claims to the land. And, you know, we've, of course, in the chapters preceding these, we've already heard the story about the Philistines. And, you know, one of the reasons people wanted a king was they had unfriendly neighbors. And, you know, so there's a pragmatic aspect to this desire. They felt the need to be unified in the way that they had not been up to that point, so they could maximize their advantages economically and militarily. And so in some ways this was a survival mechanism and an aspiration to greatness. But the fact that God, through his covenant, had promised this to them and had proven the promise over and over again, this was nothing less than a betrayal of God, because they wanted something more concrete. And so in a way, the desire for a king was an act of idolatry, an act of incarnate idolatry. But God sanctioned it nonetheless. Sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for, because sometimes God will give it to you. You know, it makes me think of folks who pray to win the lottery, and then they do, and then their lives change radically. And, you know, they've done studies of people who have won lotteries, and their self-reported happiness scales in the wake of having won it are much lower than at least their perception of their happiness beforehand, because life gets a lot less simpler. Yes, Carolyn.
About the lots.
Yeah.
Were they like dice, or were they like pieces of straws, like?
Yeah, we really don't know what mechanism they used. I guess in my mind's eye, when I read the story, I just see stones. You know, like for us, white marble, black marble, type of thing. But there's any one of a number of ways that they could have done it. Yeah.
Is Ammon Jordan the word Ammon from the Ammonites?
Yes. In fact, the current site of Ammon was the capital of the Ammonite Empire.
Oh.
Yeah.
One is carrying three young goats, mm-hmm. Another three loaves of bread, another skin of iron.
Yep.
I mean, is there any symbolic about those three choices?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, three for us is, you know, such a sacred number. This simply could have been a requirement of the law for the type of sacrifice that they intended to offer. I couldn't point you to where that might be in the Torah, or they might have been following a custom rather than a requirement of the law, or it might have been this is what they had. I mean, it is intriguing that between the three kids, the three loaves of bread and the skin of wine, they had seven separate offerings to offer, which is a sacred number for us, but also in ancient Judaism. But I wouldn't read too much into that. You know.
Well, when this was happening, they had no foreknowledge of what we would now read into it.
Right.
The bread and wine and the sacrificial animal.
Yeah, and I think as Christians, we can certainly, you know, view this, you know, theologically as, you know, as I said, it's kind of a sacramental reality that they would give him loaves of bread that had originally been intended for sacrifice to God, tying back to him getting the thigh back in chapter 9, which would normally be reserved for the priest after the sacrifice. And, you know, we're into a season now where we prepare for the arrival of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. A king who supersedes all the kings of Scripture. So, you know, there's certainly resonances with our experience of God as the Son incarnate. You know, that, you know, as you read this, you know, it's not an invalid mental tingle, I guess is what I'd say. So.
I'm impressed with the picture of Saul's humanity. His cowardice in some respects, and his—I don't know whether it's all humility. I think similar to Peter, of the position that maybe he's being placed in. He's hiding because of, he's kind of. No way does it say he accepts this.
Well, and part of that reluctance is to present a contrast between Saul and David. I mean, you see in these stories an immense amount of ambivalence about the kingship. It's both affirmed and, you know, there's a great deal of reluctance expressed by Saul, by Samuel, and by God. David presents a much more idealized portrait of kingship. You know, he volunteers to fight Goliath, which is an immensely brave thing. And, of course, he had a troubled rise to the throne, and afterwards he made great mistakes, though on balance he was the best of all the kings. So there's a kind of debate going on in 1 Samuel about, is this really a good idea? And on the whole, it's not. But it happened. And so there's an attempt here, I think, to discern how God's will was working through this improper request for a king to achieve some good things through people like David and Solomon and some of their successors, but to demonstrate in Saul the very fallible humanity of anyone who would be elevated to this position, and the fundamental mistake that the people made in asking for a king.
Well, I had to look at what's that man's name, the Ammonites. Why would you want a king if you had an next door neighbor in the hash?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it, you know, certainly, you know, the warning was quite clear, you know, in the oracle that Samuel delivered in chapter 8, starting in verse 11. I mean, this king is just going to rob you blind. You know, in addition to the tithe you owe to the Lord, he's going to expect 10% of all of your produce. He's going to take your kids and turn them into soldiers. And he's going to take your daughters and, you know, put them to work at his court. And, you know, did everything he could to dissuade them from this course of action. But on the other hand, you know, if you've got a neighbor to the east like Nahash, you've got to be thinking to yourself, you know, it's about time we had a king and did some eye gouging of our own. Or at least, you know, keep this guy, you know, deter this fellow from, you know, treating us in this way. And
especially since the ark had evidently failed them.
Yeah. I mean, there was a measure of insecurity in that instance because they misinterpreted why the ark did not lead them to victory as it had done so many times before. They didn't recognize their own infidelity as the obstacle to God's power working through that artifact. Although, when you consider what happened to the Philistines when they took it, you would have thought that they, you know, when they come to you saying, please take it back, you would think perhaps their confidence in the ark would have been renewed. But, you know, they're fickle people just like we can be, and they want security desperately. They want order. They took a shortcut, a costly shortcut, although they did benefit from it to some degree. I mean, you certainly see that in chapter 11. Saul led them to victory over a foe that obviously they, you know, had no hope of defeating before.
The 12 tribes of Israel are on both sides of the Jordan River, is that right?
There was some territory on the eastern side of the Jordan River that was claimed by the tribes. It's one thing to claim territory, it's quite another to actually be able to hold it and control it. And if you've got a good study Bible, there should be back in the back a map that shows you where the claims of these tribes are. And what you'll see as you look at the map is that to the east of the Jordan River, you're going to say, like in my map, it's purple, Manasseh, Reuben, but basically right on top of that, you see Amorites, Moab, Bashan, and so all of this territory was being contested on a regular basis. And sometimes they did well, and sometimes they didn't do so well. I totally get why they wanted a king. You know, they needed to do something to try to, you know, provide some measure of security. And since it seemed to be working so well for all their neighbors, then why not give it a go? You know. So see, that's why you'll see that sort of overlap. Yeah, it's intriguing that he was sent to an outpost, a garrison outpost, and, you know, at this point, I think it's safe to assume that the situation that prevailed in preceding chapters after, you know, they sort of basically pushed the Philistines back to a narrow strip of land along the Mediterranean coast, that still would have obtained. And I don't know if there's a meaning in him being sent to this sort of border area to meet these prophets. Maybe in a way it's as the third and final and climactic sign that will be fulfilled of his rightful claim to the kingship. Sending him to a contested territory may be a foreshadowing, a prophetic foreshadowing of sorts of what's going to really bring him into his kingship and in all of its fullness through his conflict with the Ammonites. Yeah.
Michael, in chapter 10, verse 9, we just heard about the three signs he would see. Mm-hmm. And it says, so when he turned his back to go from Samuel, God gave unto him another heart.
Yeah.
Was it necessary, you think? Did God have that little faith in him that he thought, I'm going to help you along here?
Well, I think it's all part of this gradual process of transformation that Saul experienced, which is really centered on this ecstasy. And it's about the Spirit of God, or the Ruach of God, which in the second creation story in Genesis 2 breathed human beings into life. It's that this Spirit is what empowers Saul to become king and accomplish the things necessary for him to be recognized as king. Because in 11, verse 6, when Saul hears about what's happening in Jabesh-Gilead, and the Spirit of God came upon Saul in power, and his anger was greatly kindled. And this is meant to emphasize the role of God in providing Saul with what we would call the grace he needed to assume this mantle, you know. Because the emphasis is Yahweh conferring the power through the mediation of a prophet for a chosen king, you know. And that's a practice that in the future the monarchy drifts away from. It becomes an inherited monarchy, which was never the original intention. And you see that as early as David passing on to Solomon, which kind of bucked the trend. Now, there was a prophet involved in the process that actually altered the line of succession through subterfuge. But as time went on, it became less a matter of God's foreordaining and more a matter of the preservation of power within a single family by handing on the throne to your son, one of your sons.
This frenzy or ecstasy that we're talking about, I remember a time that we were in Jerusalem and we saw this man with a flute, and he had these groups with him, and they were going up to the Wailing Wall, I think, and they were dancing and.
That was Rand Corinth and that was the Bar Mitzvah.
Oh, it was a
bonus. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it was very lively.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were obviously sort of different types of prophets or men of God operating. I mean, we have no sign that Samuel, you know, had these sort of ecstatic, sort of trance-like experiences. His is a much more sober and reasoned response to God's call. But there also apparently were charismatic prophets who also were receiving the word of God and expressing it in a very exuberant way. So there are different ways to serve as conduits of God's message. And I think that's very valuable insight for us to have today, that even as far back as very ancient times, that, you know, God found a way to transmit truth in a whole host of people and ways, and it's something that we too often forget. You know, that we oftentimes are tempted to scorn the charismatics for lack of reverence and dignity, and they in turn are often tempted to look down upon us as the frozen chosen who aren't nearly as excited as we should be. But joy can express itself in many forms.
And King David also.
Yeah, when they brought the ark into Jerusalem, David decided to dance. He was probably in a loincloth. He probably wasn't stark naked. It depends on how you interpret it. But he was getting racy, we'll get to that when we get to that. But that's going to be a fun Wednesday morning when we get to talk about that. But
that reminds me of the Scottish. His dancing on the stars, the winning contestant was Scottish.
And
he danced in a
grill
and he lifted up his grill.
Mm-hmm.
And
everybody's
been
Scottish. Yeah, and I mean, it's.
The thought of, in a couple of days, 300,000 men turning out because they didn't want to have their oxen bumped off.
Well, it was hard to plow without them, and it was an agrarian society, and much of your wealth was tied up in your stock for that reason, and so the threat of the slaughter of your oxen was a powerful motivator, and there's a potential metaphorical meaning in this as well, that we'll start with the auction, we'll finish with you. It's remarkable that, if you take the numbers that are listed literally, instead of using a different interpretive matrix to, see that these enormous numbers were given as a way to magnify a sense of Saul's authority and power, but for them to muster in 7 days and to organize themselves. We have the finest military in the world, and organizing 300,000 troops would take us several months to get them armed, in location, organized, and ready to deploy. So, you know, I just, it was a substantial number of troops, no matter how you cut it.
It's sort of mind-boggling to think that they were capable of getting themselves organized into divisions and companies and platoons and leaders and everything else in that period of time. I mean, how long are we talking after they bashed the Philistines up?
It's not certain based on the text. I mean, it could have been months, it could have been years, and we do have to remember that, you know, the tribes were accustomed to, you know, responding. They sort of had a militia, basically able-bodied men, whose responsibility was to respond to external threats. So there would have already been a measure of organization in place, but this would have been difficult, and it really is a sign of leadership, you know, because trying to merge two divisions in a battlefield setting is very difficult. Taking the forces from these 12 tribes and getting them organized and capable of executing a fairly complex military maneuver, I mean, it's quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it's... Well, he would have participated as a Benjamite in conflicts. You know, it's likely that he participated in the battles against the Philistines, so he wouldn't have been completely foreign to how all this worked. But it was just done on such a scale because, again, the complete unity of the tribes in responding to this threat was rare, if not unprecedented.
You can also say that God used this threat to unify the tribes, to get behind the chosen king.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't truly accepted by the people until this happened.
Right.
His anointing was witnessed and all of that, but they really didn't truly accept him until he had proven himself worthy.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, God oftentimes works through historical events in order to further his purposes. So I wouldn't say that God sent the Ammonites to these poor people. I think that, yeah, God takes these opportunities. And this was necessary. This event was necessary for Saul to essentially win the people's full confidence.
And if it wasn't this event, it would have had to be another event.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this was the one that's recorded.
Yeah.
So today, is there still that conflict going on today between?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's one of the most troubled places on earth, and you know, I had a friend who had an interesting experience when he was touring the Holy Land. He was riding in a taxi, and you know, traveling, you know, outside Jerusalem, and the taxi driver was narrating, you know, this battle and this battle and this battle. And initially, this guy thought he was maybe talking about some of the wars that had occurred, you know, since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. And he gradually realized that this taxi driver was describing battles that had happened thousands of years ago as if they had been relatively recently. So memory is long in that part of the world. And, you know, the tensions between Israel and all of their neighbors, for which both parties share blame, or I should say all parties, because there's more than two parties involved, that remains very, very high. I mean, it's probably the most priceless real estate on the planet. And, you know, I was reading a story just the other day about you know, mounting conflict between Jordan and Israel over distribution of water from the River Jordan. Mm-hmm. And there was an episode of The West Wing, if you ever watched that. It was first aired in the aughties. It was aired in the aughties. And there was of course, they were trying to resolve a conflict in the Middle East. And President Bartlett said, you know, once my daughter was in school and the question was asked about, you know, why there's been continual conflict in this part of the world, and she talked about, you know, the religious and political and economic realities, and the teacher told her, no, you're wrong. This is all caused by the fact that it's incredibly hot and there's not enough water. In fact, yeah, I mean,
that's true, but I still remember, and I've said it before, the Jewish professor who said that there's always going to be conflict in Jerusalem until people realize that it doesn't belong to any of us, it belongs to God.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair estimate. In fact, it's arguable that Jerusalem, for all three peoples of the book, serves as a kind of idol. You know, I understand the importance of sacred space, but any sacred space, whether it's a building like the chapel next door to us, or you know, a patch of land where some marvelous things happened, any of that can become an idol, and it's easy to lose sight of what God wants in terms of justice and mercy because of this desperate desire to see to seize this little piece of land so you can declare yourself somehow superior to others.
Even
Caroline.
Even the Christians in the Holy
Sepulchre. Yeah, we talked about that last week or last before, the conflict among Christians in those sacred spaces. Caroline.
The depth of this conflict, even in our day, because of the way that we look at our forebears. Hmm. Now, many people are interested in ancestry now, but it's you know, my forebears haven't always lived here, mm-hmm. in Kentucky, nor have they always lived here in the United States, but in places like Jordan and in the Middle East, their ancestors back to time immemorial lived there. Mm-hmm. And they know it. And this business of Ammon and the Amorites, they know all about that. And we don't think about what our ancestors might have done 2,000 years ago, or however many years ago it was. We don't think in those terms, but that is something that they have inbred in them almost. It's theirs.
Other than Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia clans, we don't hold grudges for that long.
Also, we are not a clan society either.
True. I mean, the the tribal clan-based society. Just had a very different mentality than what we're accustomed to. The bonds of connection were very fierce, and especially in an agrarian and pastoral society, land is everything. It's absolutely everything. So this is about life, you know, and it's gone on from time immemorial, you know, and but this is far from the sole place where those ongoing conflicts, I mean, we could do an entire course on, you know, the blood that's been spilled to seize little slices of Europe over the millennia. Or you pick any place in the world you like. I mean, you know, we came and grabbed land and, you know, pushed the peoples who were here before Europeans farther and farther west until we sequestered them onto usually pretty poor quality lands and contain them. and It's about sheer power, displacement, dominance. That's what all of it is. It happened in Joshua when the people came out of the wilderness and displaced the people living in the land. It happened in 1948, you know, when, you know, just imagine that you're somebody who's been farming the same olive orchard for 3 or 4 or 5 generations, and all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, well, the United Nations has decided that this isn't yours anymore because we all feel really badly about the Holocaust. Yeah, Daryl. Oh, I thought you had your hand up. Well, say something anyway. Just kidding. I'm not going to put you on the spot.
Do you know why he chose the right eye?
Generally, right and left. You would eat with your right hand. You would do other things with your left. And that's still the custom in a lot of Semitic tribes today.
That's why we
have cancer with our right hands. Yeah. The left hand is considered to be sinister. In fact, the word sinistro, Latin for sinister, means left-handed. And it's only a small minority. I think it's about 10% of people who are left-handed. And basically, if you're different in a lot of societies, then you are bad.
There was a conjecture in the notes in my Bible that the shield was normally held in the left hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that eye was sort of covered by the shield, so if you got it out the right.
Interesting.
Eye.
That's an interesting insight. Yeah.
Mine says most swordsmen were the right handed, so they held the shield this way, and that was what they were.
So you'd be blinded by your shield and severely compromised in battle if you.
You would not be able to fight.
That makes perfect sense.
Unless you managed to get an army of left eye, left eye. It took a little longer than 7 days.
The triumph of the lefties. So anything else about any of this?
Well, you're talking about clans and tribes, anybody who's got Irish or Scottish blood in them knows that that's still fiendishly wicked up there. I think they're they make do when they're playing England rugby, but that's
the union of the tribes to try to conquer a foreign foe. Yeah, I mean, there's still tribalism. In fact, you can read about it in news stories that, you know, we are now and have been moving in our own society to a more tribal perspective. You know, where there's very little, if any, middle ground. And you're either red or you're blue. You either support certain people and policies or you don't. And there's no legitimate conversation to be had. You either believe in this fact or you believe in that fact. And, you know, this tribal mentality of conformity is something that's reemerging in our society, and I think that's one of the reasons why journalists and scholars have resorted to the term tribal to describe all of this, because of the stark enmity and the enhanced sense of belonging. And, you know, it's probable, in my mind at least, that one of the reasons why we are moving to a more tribal mentality is the sense of dislocation that so many people have increasingly felt over the past decades as we become a more diverse society and dislocated one. I mean, 50 years ago, most people, you know, were born, lived, and died within 50 miles. And now we're flitting all across the country and our families are dispersed. And Jen?
I'm currently reading Hillbilly
Elegy. It's a good book. I read that, yeah.
But it's, nobody ever remembers that we're born into a mentality, it's us against them. Mm-hmm. And it has been in his story, because they had left Kentucky and went up to Ohio, but they took and the land, the cultural rhythm of the land had been, you know, people, they were always afraid somebody's going to grab their land. Mm-hmm. And so it was just, it was never a negotiation or common sense, but that's their mentality. And he said they don't know what they're fighting about, but they know that they have to fight those people.
Yeah. So. Here's a, I was listening this morning to, I think he's a private professor who's conducted polls among the millennials, mm-hmm. the young people that are finally now outnumbering all the rest of us. They have grown up with a more diverse nature among themselves. They're looking for more equality for all people. Mm. So there's hope in them, I think, to cut through some of this tribal mentality. Mm-hmm. Because they're saying, you know, that the different political parties are in danger because these millennials, they're going to align themselves either party. They're going to be free to vote for the person, no matter what party they come on, if that person stands up for what they think is mm-hmm. the way they believe. So there's really hope in our young people. The pendulum is probably swinging.
As history often does. We've just got a few more minutes, so I want to let you know next week we're going to plunge into chapters 12 and 13. And we will continue going through the 20th. So we will be meeting the Wednesday before Christmas. But the Wednesday after Christmas, the 27th, we won't meet. I suspect many of us will be entertaining guests or out of town. I know that I'll be with my parents down at the farm. So we'll resume the first Wednesday of January, whatever that is. I think it's the 4th. The 3rd, yeah. Yeah. Clergy love it when Christmas Eve falls on the 4th Sunday of Advent, and then the following Sunday is on New Year's Eve. So, But it's only every 7 years, so we manage. So why don't we conclude by saying Our Father together, and then we'll move out into our days. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Thanks for a great time, guys.